Okay, it's great to be back with everyone. Thanks so much. It was a great first class last week, and I look forward to continuing the conversation. So let me just pull up our screen here for a minute about where we are in the course. As you'll recall from last week, we spoke about Jews and an obligation, or maybe lack thereof, to spread observance of the seven Noahide laws, and started to raise some broader questions of, well, you know, did you see ourselves as responsible for spreading Jewish values into the public sphere, particularly, but not only, you know, when we're talking about here, particularly in the Western countries, but not only, right? This big issue also contemporary Israel. And the question becomes as well, how do we see our responsibility and role? And we're going to be talking about end-of-life issues and end-of-life care issues in particular in this course. And in order to appreciate a bit of where we might go with this, I think it's important to dedicate class towards thinking about what values in general, before we even get to public policy, Jews bring to the question of end-of-life, and particularly with regard to the question of quality of life, so to speak, in halacha. So when I think about this question, I recall a lot of times, and this will be very, very relevant to our course as a whole, the teachings of Rabbi Lord Emanuel Jacobovitz itself. Lord Jacobovitz was the chief rabbi of Great Britain for many years. Before that, you know, he was the chief rabbi of Ireland, and then I think the rabbi of the Fifth Avenue Synagogue, if I'm not mistaken, in New York City. And Rabbi Jacobovitz was a, I think one of the, there are other influential, of course, British chief rabbis, but Rabbi Jacobovitz had a particularly interesting role in public discourse in England and United Kingdom. He became a lord after a very interesting incident in the early 80s. As you'll recall, Margaret Thatcher had instituted small C conservative economic reforms to the UK, and what's known as Thatcheronomics, right? And the Archbishop of Canterbury at the time came out with a strong critique in the name of religion against Margaret Thatcher. And Lord Jacobovitz, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, had a more, you know, liberal and progressive view about economics and quote unquote social justice, and was very critical of some of the initiatives taken by the Thatcher government. And in response to that, Lord Jacobovitz, then at the time Chief Rabbi Jacobovitz, wrote a response in which he defended Thatcheronomics and defended the policies of Margaret Thatcher to what he called, what he believed was necessary to get people to make initiatives to work and make their own living. And Prime Minister Thatcher goes on to the floor of Parliament, and she makes a remarkable statement, which is that I wish the chief rabbi was the Archbishop of Canterbury. Right now, if you know anything about the history of British Jewry, to have the Prime Minister say, I wish the chief rabbi was the head of the Anglican Church, is quite a remarkable statement. And that was the most famous of many statements and interactions that Rabbi Jacobovitz had in the public sphere, in the public domain. He had a lot to say about Sabbath, you know, what we call blue laws and Sunday laws. He had a lot to say about the Arab-Israeli conflict. He had a lot to say about the Falklands War and a whole slew of other issues. So Rabbi Jacobovitz, because of the interaction, right, in the public sphere, is one of the things that distinguished him, and eventually they make him a lord. But Rabbi Jacobovitz is probably most famous, certainly in Jewish circles, for innovating the field of modern Jewish bioethics, medical ethics. What I mean by that is there are many who speak about you know, what Jews might have to do as a matter of law when it comes to medicine. And Rabbi Jacobovitz tried to bring Jewish thought into public discourse and turn it into an ethical discourse. So it's something that could be taught and preached, as it were, the public sphere. He writes, in fact, in the beginning of his book, Jewish Medical Ethics, which is really the first attempt to have a systematic treatment of Jewish thought on these topics. He says, you know, I was in Ireland, I saw all the Catholics in Ireland had a very systematic way of thinking about these issues of bioethics and public discourse. And it was such a shame that Jews don't have the same. And that inspired him to write his doctorate and eventually the book on the topic of Jewish medical ethics. Okay, so Rabbi Jacobowitz, partly because of his position, but partly also because of his role in innovating this field, had a oversized influence in many ways when it comes to questions of bioethics and Jewish perspective on that, particularly when it comes to the public sphere. So, you know, his perspectives on things in some ways, today less so, but for a while, was seen as sort of like the mainstream or prominent Jewish voice, or certainly the Orthodox Jewish voice. By the way, raise your hand. Anyone here related to Rabbi Jacobowitz? Just by curiosity. The only reason why I ask is that every time I mention Rabbi Jacobowitz in a public shiur, somehow someone is always related to him. It's amazing. And they explain to me, apparently they had a very large family. So I don't know. But in any case, okay, I don't see any hands. But as we're going to see today, I actually don't agree with Rabbi Jacobowitz on the topic we're going to be discussing, which is also why I asked, is anyone related? But I want to just say from the get-go, despite my intellectual disagreement here with his position, certainly have much respect for what he tried to accomplish and respect for his views in general. Okay, so Rabbi Jacobowitz made a number of statements on the issue of the principles, right, of what guides Jewish thinking when it comes to these issues of bioethics, and particularly end-of-life care. And in particular, he's responding in a time period in which people are promoting this idea of quality of life. Now, what we mean by quality of life is saying that if a person, because of technology, because of medicine, we can keep them alive in one form or another, right, in terms of biological, as an organism, of course, they're alive, but their quality of life in terms of their pleasure, the meaningful interactions with other people is greatly reduced. Is this a factor that should impact the way we think about, right, end of life care decision making? Right? And already, and certainly in the 70s and 80s, this is a big deal that people are starting to talk about this issue and promote it as a major factor in the way in which we should think about these issues. And Rabbi Jacobowitz came out strongly against this. And I want to show you some of the statements that he made along these lines. Okay, so here's a passage from him in this book that I mentioned before, Jewish Medical Ethics, in which he says as follows. Okay, he's talking about euthanasia, which we'll be talking about in future classes. But here's what he has to say. In the matter of euthanasia, for instance, any deliberate act to hasten death, whether with or without the patient's consent, is incompatible with the Jewish understanding of the sanctity of life. Okay? Now, in of its own right, this is not a controversial statement. The euthanasia is problematic, but here comes the point about the sanctity of life. Judaism regards every human life from the moment of birth as being of infinite value. Infinity, by definition, is indivisible. So that any fraction of life, whether 10 years or a minute, whether healthy, crippled, or even unconscious, remains equally infinite in value. By attacking the ebbing life of a terminal patient because it's deemed worthless, we would rob all human beings of their absolute claim to life, making it merely relative to the expectancy of life, the state of health, or the usefulness to society, or to any other arbitrary criteria. In other words, what Rabbi Jacobowitz is trying to stress is, if you believe in this notion, at least his notion, of the sanctity of life, what it means is that all moments of life have infinite value and they're all equal. And he's very clear about this, right? Let's just see it again, his statement. It doesn't matter whether people are healthy, crippled, or even unconscious. It doesn't matter we're talking about 10 years or a minute, right? infinity, by definition, is indivisible. And any of these attempts in order to judge the value of a moment of life ultimately is an attack on the notion of the sanctity of life. So there is a very high publicity, right? It's a very high, highly discussed, greatly discussed case in which there is a case of killing a child with Down syndrome. And that's led people to start talking about, you know, what's the value of life at that moment. And Rabbi Jacobus had this to say: where there is life, there may not always be hope, but there is always the spark of a uniquely precious soul, radiating warmth and compassion by its very existence. Okay, so you see this notion again, no matter what, right, there's always a soul that's radiating. Every moment of life, no matter what the condition, is of equal value. And when Rabbi Moshe David Tendler passed away a couple of years ago, started promoting the idea of a living will. Living will is a document. I highly recommend it, as you'll see how we go about in our conversation, is a document which people express, right, their values and preferences when it comes to end of life care treatment. And Rabbi Tendler started promoting this idea that Jews should sign it because it might say that we don't want have certain treatments. We want to forego or withhold certain treatments. And Rabbi Jacobowitz was very against this. And he said, contrary to Rabbi Tendler, I would also include blood transfusion as well among natural means to stay in life. In other words, these are things you cannot withhold. I also question Rabbi Tendler's reference to the quality of life. I believe in the Jewish view, this has no bearing on the value of life, which is absolute and infinite, and certainly not subject to assessment by the patient or anyone else. This led me to my main critique. I believe the whole notion of a living will is alien to Jewish thought and law. The Jewish imperative of saving life are incumbent equally on a patient, doctor, rabbi, and friends. Of these, the patient is obviously the least objective, being the most interested party. So what he's basically saying is, even if the patient says, I don't want this treatment, right, don't give it to me. What is Rabbi Jacobowitz's statement, response? All life is of equal value, of infinite value, and that patient's view is irrelevant. Okay, so I'm setting this up because many times, in fact, this position gets quoted as a dominating Jewish perspective on end-of-life issues, with this notion of sanctity of life. And, you know, in some ways, it's pretty monolithic, right? It's a perspective which says there's one value which matters most, and it's the only value that really matters, and we need to keep on giving treatment, whether it's blood transfusions or other things, to keep people's hearts beating. Now, it's clear from the statements that Lord Jacobus is making, he was responding to the time period. Right? He's very much responding to his fear, which is, as we're going to discuss, right, is not without reason, right? He has what to be afraid of people downgrading the notion of sanctity of life and not treating with care end of life as a whole. You know, in certain countries around the world, you'll find healthcare policies, for example, where they'll say, why give anyone dialysis after the age of 75? What's the point anyway? Right, which, you know, as we'll discuss in coming conversations, this is quite problematic. But nonetheless, the question is Rabbi Jacobowitz's perspective here with this sort of monolithic principle an accurate description of what Judaism has to say on this topic? Okay. I see, by the way, already, which is great, in the chat, people are starting to raise questions. What about prolonging life versus prolonging dying? Right? What about forcing and right refusal? All of these are going to be topics we're going to be covering in the coming sessions. So I'm glad we're already thinking ahead, but I want to establish some principles in the class today. And so Rabbi Jacobowitz is, as a pioneer in Jewish medical ethics, is having a major influence. He's sort of the major Jewish voice. He's leading, chairing many Jewish medical conferences. But as you saw already, some disagree with him, including Rabbi Tendler, who is coming at the perspective also, not just of his own, but also promoting the perspective of his father-in-law, of Moshe Feinstein. And in the academic world, there are a number of Jewish professors, bioethicists, who are also saying, I'm not so sure this is an accurate depiction of Jewish thought on it. Now, it happens to be that one of those who was a frequent interlocutor with Rabbi Jacobowitz was a man named Professor Baruch Brody of Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Professor Brody happens to have been also my father, my beloved father, but I'm totally not biased in my presentation on this issue at all whatsoever. Okay. I of course, mean that somewhat jokingly, but nonetheless, I think my father's dispute with Lord Jacobowitz, which took place at a number of conferences over the years, is quite relevant for our conversation. And here's where my father's argument, the upshot
of
it.
Can we have those sources in the chat?
Yes. I meant to send that along the way, and I will try to figure out how to share that as we go along here. My father, there's a number of different articles where he makes this point. This comes from a book called Taking Issue, Pluralism and Casuistry in Bioethics. My father is a brilliant man, but marketing was not his thing. And so when you call a book by the title of Pluralism and Casuistry, right, you are guaranteeing that this is going to have a limited catch audience. This is not quite Harry Potter branding. But what he means by this is follows. Casuistry is case-based decision-making, right? You take each case on its own. And here he means by pluralism, he's just saying that there are multiple values. There are plural values which you're going to apply to each of these cases. And his argument goes as follows. Okay? The belief in the sanctity of human life is the belief that every moment of biological life of every member of our species is of infinite value. This belief has profound implications for medical ethics as it stands in opposition, for example, to most recent discussions of death with dignity, which emphasize patient autonomy and quality of life rather than the sanctity of human life. Meaning, if you believe in this notion of sanctity of human life, certainly in the version of it, of Rabbi Jacobowitz, so you are not going to be interested in patient autonomy, as we saw with Rabbi Jacobowitz's statement on the living will, or this entire notion of quality of life. And here my father goes on to say, Judaism has not traditionally stressed patient autonomy and has, on the whole, opposed suicide and euthanasia. I shall argue, however, that is not committed to a belief in the sanctity of human life, to belief that mere physical existence is in the patient's best interest, or to believe that residual life in pain has infinite worth. In other words, Judaism, while it doesn't stress patient autonomy, is not really interested in arguing that just the mere physical existence, no matter under what condition, is always in the best interest of the patient or that has infinite worth. Okay? And to the contrary, we're going to see that there are multiple values which sometimes trump over, right, which override notions of the sanctity of life, of Kedushat HaChayim, and that has major implications for bioethical dilemmas. Because once you're willing to acknowledge the fact that there are other values that go into the conversation, once you're willing to say that values like quality of life or what the patient is feeling, right, a patient wants, patient autonomy, has some form of moral weight. So that's going to complicate how you deal with many different cases. And indeed it does. Right? And I would argue, and as we're going to see in the coming weeks, many of the debates that we're having today with end-of-life care, whether it's in Canada or in Israel, the United States, or other places, is precisely because there's this dispute over which values should take primacy. Okay. But in Rabbi Jacobowitz's view, this is really a misguided discussion because the only value that really matters is the sanctity of life. Okay. And now what we have to see is, well, where do you see the sources in one direction or another? In other words, Is there a way here to show, to prove, right, that there's a better case to be made in Jewish thought with either Rabbi Jacobowitz's perspective, which is a monolithic one? I don't mean that as a criticism. Monolithic in the sense that he's promoting one value as the key value, right? Or is it complicated by multiple values, plural values, that have to be applied in complex manners in different scenarios, right? I think that's correct. And by the way, there's other monolithic, you know, viewpoints as well. So if you promote, as many ethicists do, many countries are headed in this direction, that the primary value is simply one of patient autonomy, that people have the right to choose what they want to do with their body. That's also a monolithic, right, vision of it. So I'm not saying that being monolithic per se is wrong or is unique to Rabbi Jacobowitz or anyone else. Right? All I'm trying to highlight here is the question of how does Judaism frame these issues? Is it a matter of one dominating value? Or is there a complex system of ethics here, which incorporates plural, multiple values? And that's going to complicate things. And I'm going to argue now that it is clear to me, at least, that we are dealing with here a system that promotes plural values, right? Multiple values. And we're going to see that in a number of different texts and stories. And that is going to complicate, and greatly complicate in many ways, the way we think about some of the end-of-life issues that are going on in contemporary society. Okay, so let's take a quick look here at some of the sources that Rabbi Jacobowitz and others have marshaled in one direction or another. So there is this law in Masechet Smachot that says as follows. Agoses, the person, it's hard to define this term, there's a whole discussion about this, but it's a person who seemingly is terminally ill and is in their last period of life. The goses harei kachai l'chodavar should be treated like a living person for all purposes, and therefore ein matzmini etenav, right? You cannot close their eyes. You cannot touch the person. A person who touches them is as if they're shofech damim. The analogy given is like a flickering candle. You put your finger next to a flickering candle. Is the candle going to go out anyway? Yes, the candle's going to go out anyway, but nonetheless, if you put your fingers on, if you touch it, it will go out faster. And they and the Masechet Smachot declares this person is a shofet damim, a killer. Okay, and this is significantly codified in classic Jewish legal texts, such as the Aruch HaShulchan in the beginning of the 20th century, who says closing a person's eyes when they're on their deathbed is like shofech damim, is killing. And he adds, v'afopi she'anu ro'im she'mitzta'er harbe b'gzisato. And even though we see that the person is suffering, v'tov lo hamavet, and it would be better for him to die, mikom makom asur lanu lasot davar l'krev mitato. It is forbidden for us to hasten someone's death. V'ha'olom u'melo'o shel kodesh baruch hu v'kach ritzono yitbarach. Because the world belongs to God, and this is his will. And this is an important theological statement here, which isn't just saying that you cannot hasten someone's death. It's also declaring a reason for that principle. Namely, that a person, that this is God's world. God has created the world this way. And heaven forfend that we should interfere with someone dying by hastening their death. Okay. Now, what exactly that looks like in the modern hospital is going to be a discussion, as we're going to see, but this is certainly a principle that is being established from Masechet Smachot. Now, this doesn't necessarily tell us, of course, that every moment of life is of infinite value, right? That doesn't tell us that at all, but perhaps we see this in another source. And this is a well-known source in Masechet Yuma, which tells us, do we save someone's life? Is pikuach nefesh doche Shabbat? The answer, of course, is yes. And we say, even if they're only going to live for a momentary period of time, right? Even if it's going to be a small amount of time, what's known in halakhic term as chaye shah, we violate Shabbat. Perhaps that teaches us that even for every moment of life is of enough value to violate Shabbat, maybe this means that every moment of life is of infinite sanctity as well. And we do have notions also of asserting that purple suffering, when a person is suffering, it has some form of spiritual value that brings them kapara, atonement. The Gemara in Brachot says, Yisurin Merakin Kol Adam Shel Adam, that a person's travails, physical travails, provide atonement for that. Although the Gemara does quickly tell us of a story of the great sages, with one of them is having Yisurin, and the students say to him, Chavivin Alechan Yisurin, right? Are these precious to you? Are enjoyable to you? And the Rav says to him, Lohen velo scharan. No, I don't want either the Yisurim or the spiritual rewards that may come from it. In other words, the Gemara already tells us right away, perhaps there might be some after the fact spiritual benefit, but despite the spiritual benefit, no one wants Yisurim. Okay? But nonetheless, we also say a pasuk in Tehillim, Yasor Yisrani ka v'lamavet lo netanani. Right, God, you can give me Yisurim, you can give me ailments, but don't kill me. And so when you take all of these examples together, this notion in Tehillim, the potential spiritual value of suffering, as well as the notion that we would violate Shabbat to save anyone's life, even of a momentary life, Chayisha, perhaps you can come to the conclusion that every moment of life is of infinite value and of great sanctity. This indeed is not only the position of Rabbi Jacobovitz, but it's also the position of, seemingly the position of the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who makes a statement and quotes these Gemara that we saw beforehand, and says, "Edni ki karim od rigei enosh alei admot." Right? No matter what, right, we should do all efforts to save someone's life, just as we do on Shabbat, right? Because every precious, how greatly precious is every human moment on this earth. Okay? And so it's certainly not Rabbi Jacob, but it's also, I would certainly put Rabbi Waldenberg, who is significantly the POSEC for many years of Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Jerusalem, right? The chief rabbinic advisor to Shaarei Tzedek, that there is this notion. Right? It is found, it's certainly found a strand of thought in Judaism, which does assert that every moment of life is of infinite value and precious. And yet, if you think about it for a moment, we seem to know other cases when we say, you know, life doesn't always trump, right? Life doesn't always, override other values. So let's think for a moment together, right? When do we know, where do we see that sometimes in Jewish law we say, no, your life is not the most important thing. And sometimes it's better to die than it is to live because of some other value, right? Do we have this notion anywhere in Jewish thought or Jewish law?
Yes, Yehareg ve'al yavor.
Right, excellent. Yehareg ve'al yavor, right? Cases of certain mitzvot which we're not allowed to violate. And we have a general principle which says sometimes we say it's better for us to be killed and die rather than violate a law. Okay, and particularly, and by the way, in medieval time period, even though the big three are the ones that people emphasize, there are also times when we say that if a person decides not to violate the law, even though, right, they technically could have. So let's give a fun case. It's a time of persecution. And the non-Jew says, I want you to eat treif. Are you allowed to say, I'd rather be martyred than eat non-kosher food? So the medievals had a discussion about this, but it seems that many felt yes. And certainly if it's a time of persecution and this is being done in public, it might be the base requirement to say it's better to be killed and to violate any of the laws during a time of persecution. There's a whole discussion about this. And what about going to war? Isn't Milchemet Mitzvah endanger people? Seemingly does. Minchat Chinuch points this out, right? So it seems that there are times when we do say that life is not always the primary value. There might be things that are greater than life. There are things that we sacrifice life for. Okay, so all I'm trying to point out from the get-go is that this whole notion of saying that life is always the primary value is clearly not true when it comes to asking questions when there are times when we say, well, there are other values as well, right, that might override even this great important value of staying alive. But it goes much more than that, because we also know that there are times in the Torah or in Tanakh where we see people, right, who take their own lives rather than either be killed or to do some other transgression. Okay, and the most famous of these examples is King Saul, Shaul HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech is losing to the Plishtim. And what does he do? Right, he asks the guy, this sword carrier, to kill him. He says no. So what does Shaul HaMelech do? He falls on his sword. Now the question is, why was that allowed? Or was it allowed? Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it shouldn't be justified. But in rabbinic literature, you see many justifications for it, right? One of those justifications is A, he knew he was going to die anyway. B, there is a national embarrassment, right? They're going to treat his body. And it also might be that he didn't want to go through, right, the torture of the people that were going to kill him. And the truth is, we see this as well with many stories in the Gemara and Gittin. You might remember from Tisha B'Av, there are a number of stories which talk about where Jews decided to die rather than, or kill themselves, excuse me, rather than be taken into slavery. So you remember the story of the 400 boys and girls who are being taken on the ship, or the mother and the seven sons, right, who, and the mother who jumps off of the roof, right? There are all these stories that talk about and it would seem to be that we're justifying this, because otherwise, why are we telling these stories? Why is that allowed? They're taking their own lives here. I mean, that's very significant. But then you look in Chazal, and it's much more than just cases of martyrdom, okay? And you see a number of times when it would seem that there is a real value to quality of life. And I don't know any other word to describe it. So let's take a look at this Yalkut Shimoni here. It tells the following story. There's a Maseb Ishachat Shinskin Arbe, a woman has become very old. Okay? And she goes to Rabbi Yosef ben Chalafta and says, Rebbe, I'm just too old now. Umachshav Chayim Shel Nivulhem, right? My life is really one of denigration. I can't eat. Right, I can't taste any food, right? I don't have any pleasure. V'anim v'keshet lipater min olam, and I want to leave this world. Now, if this woman was asking this question to Rabbi Jacobovitz, what should Rabbi Jacobovitz say?
No good.
He can't leave this world. Every moment of life is of infinite value, right? He should say, sorry, lost track here. He should say something like this to the woman. Where there is life, there may not always be hope, but there is always a spark of uniquely precious soul radiating warmth and compassion by its very existence. But that is not what Rabbi Yosef ben Chalafta says to her. Rabbi Yosef ben Chalafta says to her, what mitzvah do you do regularly? And she says back to him, it's very precious to me. Every morning I get up and go to shul. Interesting in its own right, that's what she says. And so he says to her, okay, this great virtue that you have, this midah, don't do it for 3 days. And she doesn't do it for 3 days. And on the third day, she dies. What does Rabbi Yosef ben Chalafta tell her? Don't do certain virtuous actions that are keeping you alive. And then you have this story as well of the city of Lutz. And the city of Lutz right? Which is a famous city, never had disturbances. Sennacherib was never able to come there. Nebuchadnezzar was never able to destroy it. And it says that the Malach HaMavet doesn't have permission to go in there. Okay, so people can live. That's great. Ella, but what does the Gemara tell us? Zikenim, Shababis Man Shidatan Katzeleh. When elderly people get to the point where they just don't want to live anymore, Datan Katzeleh. Yotzin Chutzlachuma, the Hen Meitim. What do? They go out of the city walls and then they can die. This is pretty shocking. Seems to be telling us that when people are tired of life in the city of Luz, what do? They leave, so that way they can die. What happened to the sanctity of life? And then you get to the well-known, probably the most famous Gemara on this topic, which tells us the story of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's death. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi here in Ketubo Kuf Dalet is a great editor of the Mishnah, and he has some form of disease, and the rabbis declare a fast day, and they say, anyone who says that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi has died, we're going to stab him with a sword. Meaning they want to keep him alive. And they're praying. And his helper, his Ozeret, right, the handmaid is helping him, goes and says, the angels above want him. The angels below, meaning the rabbis want him. Let the angels below win. Then she sees that he has to keep on taking off his tefillin because he has to keep on using the restroom. He has some form of a bowel disease or infection or something along those lines. And she sees the pain he's in and she prays and says, let the angels above win. And the angels above win. Wow, that means that she wants him to die. But he can't die because everyone is still praying for him. Now, how do you get a room to be very quiet and stop praying?
Imagine you drop something.
What do you say?
You drop something very heavy.
You drop something very heavy. And before everyone has a moment to scream Mazel Tov, there's that infinite second in which everyone gets very quiet. And that's exactly what she does. She takes a shard of pottery. She throws it to the ground. All the rabbis pray and go, oh. They stop for that moment. Boom. He dies. But doesn't every moment of life have infinite value? Now, what does Rabbi Waldenberg say? Who do we paskin like? We rule like the rabbis, not the handmaiden. Yeah, but if that was the case, would the Gemara tell us this story? And then you get to probably the most important source on this topic, which is the Gemara in the Nedarim, which tells us that Rabbi Akiva went to visit one of his six students. And Rabbi Akiva sees the student. The student says, you've resuscitated me. You've rejuvenated me. Rabbi Akiva goes out and declares, anyone who doesn't visit the sick, right? It's as if you've killed the person. So they say, what? And he rephrases it. He says, no. If you don't visit the sick, Ein mevakesh alav rachamim, lo sheyichya, v'lo sheyamut. It's a problem. If you don't visit the sick, you don't pray for mercy on them, not that they should live or that they should die. What does that mean? Does that mean sometimes we should pray for someone to die? And the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, the 14th century, says, yes, that's exactly what it means. Sometimes when people are having a miserable state of affairs in life, like Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was, and he says, a person who's really suffering, and he cannot, right, survived, meaning he's both terminally ill and suffering. Those are two important categories here, terminally ill and suffering. The Ran says the appropriate response is to pray for mercy that the person should die. Don't say Mishaberach and Shul. Pray for the person to die. Unless you think, we would never do such a thing. So the Aruch HaShulchan tells us, the same Aruch HaShulchan who we started this year with, who said you can never do anything to hasten someone's death, says, Lifamim yesh levakesh rachamim sheyamut. Sometimes we should pray that God should have mercy and the person should die. Kigon sheyesh lo yisurin harbei b'chalyor. When a person has many suffering greatly, and cannot be healed. In the 18th century, the Pachad Yitzchak of Yitzchak Lamportini composed a prayer. An Hashem, please God, in your great rachamim, take this soul back to you. Bring his soul back to his maker. Okay? So you seem to see here very clearly in a number of stories, including the story of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, this notion of saying that sometimes Judaism understands that life is not of infinite value. When a person is suffering and they're terminally ill, it's not the same value as when a person is 42 or 18 and perfectly healthy. Not the same. Or for that matter, 80, but perfectly healthy and great shape. Right? If they're terminally ill and they're suffering, it is not the same. Okay. Now, if that's correct, and I think it is, then the question then becomes, what are the implications, right? How far do you go for this? Okay. And here we see in contradiction to Rabbi Jacobowitz and Rabbi Waldenberg, a real strand of Jewish thought, which asserts that sometimes we don't take actions in order to save someone's life, because saving their life at that moment is not doing them a favor. And I just want to give you a little bit of a taste of some of these positions that we're going to see much more in depth in the coming weeks. But if you see here in Rav Shlomo Zalman Orban, Shut Minchat Shlomo, discusses the case, right, of a person who's terminally ill and suffering, right, and says the fact that we would violate Shabbat to save their life doesn't tell us that that life is of infinite value. It just means that Shabbat is not the priority over life. But that doesn't mean every moment of life is of infinite value. And then he goes on to explain, right? I have cases in which someone says that they are really suffering. So I think you should forego treatments. Right? You should forego, let's say, you know, various medicines, right, that aren't really going to help someone. Okay? Now, Lord Jacobowitz doesn't believe that. He's not an evil man by any means. He's just thinking about it in terms of one principle. And Rabbi Orbach is saying in response to that is, there's other principles here. In fact, Rabbi Chaim David Alevi, who's the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, said that sometimes it is not only permissible to forego treatment, he felt sometimes it's usher, it's forbidden to give it treatments. And the case he gives is very controversial. He says that if a person is terminally ill and suffering, I think also he has in mind here a case of someone who's also unconscious. So not only do you not have to put person on a ventilator in this moment, it is usher to keep them on a ventilator. Because all you're doing at that moment is extending dying, not extending living. Why would you want to extend anyone's painful dying process? Now, we're going to get into these questions of withdrawing and holding at greater length. But what I want to try to establish here is precisely this point of saying that the way we look at end-of-life care issues is not monolithic. Certainly not only relates to patient autonomy, but it also doesn't relate to just the quantity of life, keeping people's hearts beating as long as possible. But rather, it does take into account questions of quality of life and trying to address people's suffering and asking, as we saw in the cases of Luz and the woman who goes to shul regularly, like maybe at some point, some people feel like this is not a life worth living anymore. And those are values which you see in our text, not some 20th century philosopher in some college, whoever is promoting liberal values. No, right? These are very human values and very humanistic values, which somehow have to also live in some form of comfort or some form of conversation with the value that we saw as well that we do not hasten someone's death. So on the one hand, we have a principle, we don't hasten someone's death. We saw that very clearly. On the other hand, we seem to say that we care a lot about people's pain and suffering, that sometimes people legitimately can say, my life isn't worth living, and we take that into consideration. We address their pain, even if sometimes we pray for people to die. How are you going to put all those principles together? That's exactly what we're going to be discussing in the coming weeks. But I want to open up for questions, but let me end with a final thought. If everything I'm saying right now is true, and I think it is, I think it clearly is, and I think it clearly actually represents a dominant stream of thought today, meaning Rabbi Jacobovitz and the Tzitzit Eliezer is no longer a mainstream position. It's certainly a position. It's out there, right? So I'm respected, it's quoted. Right, but I don't think it's a dominant position. Okay, and why did they see these sources? Did they not know these sources? So, A, yes, I think they knew these sources, but I think a couple of things were going on. One is that many of these sources are stories, gadatot. And the question becomes, right, how much value do you attribute to some of these stories of gadatot? You could say, okay, those are stories. That's interesting. People did what they did. Just because you tell a story doesn't mean that's how we should normatively behave. You could make such an argument. Although you'd have to wonder, right, why do we record those stories in the Talmud if we didn't want them to have influence in the way we behave? I think the second factor, and particularly when it comes to Rabbi Jacobovitz, that drove him to take such a strong stand on the sanctity of life is his perception that society as a whole has gone to another extreme, and we need to come back and push back at it with a very clear, monolithic, unified, principled voice. Because that's what the period calls for. Now, I'm not saying that's what he's consciously thinking, but I think that that was driving much of the way he thought on this issue. And in a number of different issues that this comes up in his writings, whether it's abortion, right, or other issues as well, you see this push from him of pushback against what he considers the excesses or even evils of secularization or modernization or liberalization when it comes to traditional religious values. Is this legitimate fear or concern? Maybe. Maybe. But then the question becomes, how do you respond? Right? Do you respond with an equally monolithic type of perspective, or do you try to respond with sophisticated, articulate, nuanced position, which takes into account multiple values and tries to balance or figure out how to apply those values in the complex technological societies that we live in? My answer to you is that's exactly what we need to be doing. And if we don't do that, we're going to betray, I think, the richness of the halachic tradition and also betray our ability to positively impact what's going on in the public sphere. And, but the details of that, of course, are very, very difficult. And that's precisely what we're going to be coming up to try to develop in the coming weeks. Let's open up for some questions here. I see also in the chats, people are starting to raise, this is interesting. Len brings up the following point. In today's world, the equivalent of the handmaiden are the chaplains and medical directors in nursing homes, hospice, and the like. I mean, that's very interesting, Len, what you're saying. That this notion of saying that the healthcare professionals today feel sometimes that we're causing people to suffer. I think there's some truth to that, but you know, I'm not sure always that the healthcare professionals are always getting this right on this. But you are correct that there are definitely many who are of the feeling that this is very interesting to discuss in the Beit Midrash or in the Ivory Tower. But when you see people suffering in real life, your perspectives on this change. And I think that's an interesting voice as well. Okay, let's go with the, if we use the hand mechanism here, that would be helpful. If anyone wants to comment. Not sure if I'm seeing people. Shelly Shapiro, go ahead.
Do you think that part of Rabbi Jacobowitz's view is based on the Catholic Church? Because you said he thought that in Ireland it's very, you know, you don't kill a prisoner, you don't get no abortion from the word go. It's very black and white. And we were never black and white.
So, you know, it's hard to know. Hard to know. He's definitely somewhat influenced by the Catholics. I'll say that there are definitely other Jewish thinkers who will say things like, how could we allow this? What will the goyim say? And the goyim they have in mind, right? Lama yomru goyim, right? The goyim, the pasuk, the goyim they have in mind is, if we allow abortions, let's say in certain cases, you know, the Catholics will think so lowly of us that we don't have high moral standards, or they have higher moral standards than us. Occasionally you do see such types of rhetoric. It could be that subtly impacted Rabbi Jacobowitz as well, but I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, I think I would read him on his own. You know, I don't like over-psychologizing people in that respect, but it's a good question. Lauren Black.
Yeah, I just want to mention, I was part of the intensive care team for quite a while at a teaching hospital in Toronto. And there's a concept of futility of care. And futility of care really means you're prolonging dying. No matter what you do, this person will die. You may keep their heart beating a little bit longer. You're probably increasing their suffering, although the patient is, you know, given sedation, and like a continuous drip of sedation, a continuous drip of analgesia, but it's hard to know, you know, whether they're suffering more or not. So I think it's something to always keep in mind that there is such a thing as it's just futile.
Yeah, so it's interesting, Lauren. Thank you for your comment. In today's medical circles, they try to avoid using actually the term futility, because futility became such a loaded concept, and it also has a connotation in some ways that it won't do anything. Well, sometimes there's something that just doesn't make sense. It's literally futile. Most of the time, though, there's a certain amount of judgment call going into that. What makes something, you know, futile? The term people sometimes use is medically inappropriate, right? That it's something which is medically not efficacious in terms of providing any cure. That doesn't mean that it's futile in the sense that could sometimes keep someone alive a bit longer. And, you know, this relates also to Lauren, to Jolaine's point here in the comments. How do you define suffering? Who's defining what suffering is? This is a massive issue, which we'll come to, you know, in the coming weeks. You know, Rabbi Herschel Schachter of Yeshiva University has the position where he basically says that if some people, let's say five, the way the percentage you use to me is 5% of people would come and say, you know, this doesn't make any sense. I don't want this type of treatment, right? In other words, it's not a case of a 50-year-old where you say, listen, we can do surgery on you. It's going to be painful for a bit, but then you're going to have a great life afterwards. And the 50-year-old says, no, I don't want to go through that. Okay, so that, Rav Schachter would say, that's unreasonable. We would tell him that you can't do that. But if, you know, other cases when a good, you know, some percentage of the population would just say, I don't want this, I want to forego it. Rav Schachter thinks that that's a legitimate criteria of suffering. We should take that into account. Other poskim are like, are you insane? Like, of course, right? How is that possibly definition? We have to have something much more concrete. So, yeah, so this question of how to define suffering is important, and you know where we want to draw the lines. And but again, it's only happening precisely because we are creating a pluralist, meaning plural. It's a system of pluralist values, which we take into account different values, and that's precisely where this is where problem emerges from. Ovadia or Dr. Homer Brooks. I'm not sure that's which is the proper name.
Either way, anything but late for dinner is absolutely fine. Okay. Yeah, so I'm a practicing physician. I just had the do not resuscitate conversation an hour ago. One thought that came to my mind was free will. You know, we as Jews believe in free will. And if God gave us free will, who are we to decide otherwise for other people, you know, and not give them that free will to be able to say, no, I don't want this, or yes, I do want that. It's not unlike, and I know you talked a little bit about abortion last time and so forth, but yeah, I think it's in El Salvador, you can't get an abortion for an ectopic pregnancy. And an ectopic pregnancy will kill you. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. We're just letting God decide. And if we're just going to let God decide, I'm not going to have a job.
Yeah. So I appreciate the point. You know, free will, you're right. Free will is does hover over these conversations. But I don't think we always say we're going to respect someone's free will. So, you know, this is actually one of the classic sources which shows that we don't promote a notion, a strong notion, at least, of human autonomy, is if someone freely says, I want to take my life. Now, again, I know this gets complicated, right? But I want to mutilate my body. Do we allow the person to take their life or mutilate the body? Free will. Answer, absolutely not. Right? We stop that. Right? We want to stop them from doing it and many other actions. So, you know, free will is complicated. It's definitely, though, an important notion of part of what it means to have human dignity is to have a certain amount of free will and be able to act on that. But sometimes we don't want people to act on that. And so I appreciate the question that you're asking, but I think it's a bit, it gets more complicated than just free will. I see Sima Hertzberg and I see Harold Pearl. Sima, go ahead.
This concept of davening for someone's death, which I understand well, but it's a really hard concept when you're talking about a loved one. So yep. To be put in full transparency, I have a 94-year-old mother who has depression and dementia and clearly does not want to go on living. But I daven for her refuah. And sometimes I feel I shouldn't be davening for her refuah. I should be davening for rachamim. I should be davening. But to have her on a refuah shalema list, to me, I struggle with that. Yeah. I don't know if I'm asking a question or just, I guess I'm asking.
I'll take it as a comment. It was the first halachic shaila I got as a rabbi was this question. I always remember it. The first question I got was from my student, who's, I think, uncle, a great uncle, was precisely in that type of situation. And he asked me how he should pray. I happened to be sitting in the Yeshiva, the Kotel Beit Midrash, where I used to teach, in the row in front of Rabbi Nevinson.
You taught my son, Adam.
Ah, okay, there you are. Okay, yes, now I'm recognizing. Hello. So it was Adam's year, actually, when I got this question. In any case, so I went to Rabbi Nevinson and said to him, you know, what do we say about this? And he said to me, I recommend you just pray for rachamim. And God will decide what rachamim means. Okay, that's actually the approach I take on that question. If you Google search praying for the terminally ill and Brody, you'll see I wrote about this somewhere. I think that's a good compromise position. I think praying for someone to die is very strong and it's emotionally right. Very difficult. But for the same reason, you know, I think that it's also hard for someone to say, you know, are we really praying for a foolish lemma? We don't believe that's really possible in this case. We don't usually pray for miracles. And, you know, we want to pray for people's best interests. So thank you for the comment.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Yes. And send regards. Harold.
I just wanted to give some further context to the story of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, which Ramosha Feinstein used cites as the main source in his tshuva, which I'm sure you'll get to at some point. But which I have used in, I was a neonatologist. I work in the intensive care unit and I sat on the bioethics committee of my hospital. But what I wanted to point out was something amazing. That one is that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was in a state of continuous resuscitation. Basically, and how were they resuscitating him? By somebody constantly had somebody who was davening for him all the time. And if somebody wouldn't daven for him, then he would die. So basically, the needs that they had to resuscitate or to maintain their life. It was not a ventilator at that time, but it was the equivalent of having somebody daven for him all the time. The second point is, what did the Gemara use as a means of teaching us this halacha? Because we then go on and say, did she do the right thing or not? And there's a debate about that. And then ultimately you say, yes, she did. Well, what was the source that they used? They didn't say that Yehuda HaNasi had a brilliant Talmud and came up with this learned chidush that you're allowed to stop. What did they say? One, they used a woman who had compassion and saw how he was suffering. Two, they used a woman who knew him best, was his housekeeper for years and years and years. So it wasn't just some, you get admitted to the hospital and some doctor now sees you for the first time and decides what you should do, what would you want to do, et cetera. But they used somebody who knew him really well and knew what he would want as well. And using all those criteria, you can then apply that to what we do nowadays as issues that we have to take into consideration.
Yeah, well, I'll focus on the second point you're making. I think it's very interesting. Does she know better? Right? Well, what did Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi want? Interestingly enough, the Gemara doesn't tell us. And so it's part of the question that becomes then is, or maybe it does. You know, I don't know. It doesn't clearly tell us this. And so, you know, does that tell us something about who should make decisions, let's say, when someone can't tell us?
Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the editor, right? So somebody had to edit this to say, what should we put in here and what should we not put in here?
Just wow.
Right?
How should we learn this?
How should we learn this and how should we not learn this?
Right, but he's the editor of the Mishnah, but not of the Gemara where the story is told, right? So this is recorded later on. So, you know, I think it's an interesting point. It's a very interesting point you're making. And there is some value to that here as well, to the who knows best here. I think there's something, you know, interesting to say for that. That's interesting, you know, comment on that. In terms of your first point, though, you know, is prayer considered to be like actively, right? It's an active form of treatment, as it were. So this is a deeper theological question. I would actually try to submit that we should keep prayer separate from thinking of it as intervention, but I understand what you're saying in this case.
For them, it was. Right?
Could be. I try to keep it separate, but it does push, and this is what pushes many of the poskim who are more interested in foregoing treatment or allowing foregoing treatment. They say this cannot be a state where you'd say you have to treat someone while you're praying for them to die. It just doesn't work. I think there's a lot to say for that. I think it's a lot for saying that. So, Harold, thank you for that comment. Ellie Passo.
Rabbi Brody, I just want to let you know that Len Thaler has also had his hand raised. I'm not sure.
Oh, I apologize. Okay, so go to Ellie and then go to Len. Go ahead, Ellie.
It's Chaya Passo, but in any case, I'm just wondering if there is a certain amount that you mentioned it, like what would Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi have wanted? Is there a possibility that sometimes we project our sufferings on the person themselves when they cannot express them? My mother had very advanced Alzheimer's for many years. And, I couldn't think, I mean, it looked like she had very little quality of life. And yet we would stroke her. We would love her. And we couldn't ask her. And yes, it was very hard to watch. But is there sometimes the danger that we decide that the person is suffering when they themselves might not choose to have the treatment withheld, et cetera?
Yes, and it goes both ways, that danger. Meaning it goes both ways. Sometimes you have people thinking, you know, oh, this is not life worth living, and the patient themselves might think, no, actually this is. And when they can communicate that, the classic example of this sometimes is the people with Lou Gehrig's disease, right, the ALS. And, you know, you might say, ah, this is not life worth living, but they're able to say, communicate with their eyes or some other way. And they, indicate, no, actually, you know, like, I appreciate this life still. And it can go the opposite way though, also, where you have family members who are like pushing their parents or loved ones and saying, you know, keep on fighting. You got to keep on fighting. You got to keep on treating. And they're not hearing or seeing their loved ones saying, like, I can't go on anymore. So, you know, it goes both ways. It is a world of uncertainty. We are dealing with a world of uncertainty, particularly in those cases, which is why I strongly recommend for everyone here on this, right, on this conversation, and we'll have other opportunities to talk about it, to write out a living will where you can indicate some of your values and preferences. Because
that doesn't mean you'll feel that way when you get to that point.
Absolutely correct. And that's why you have to constantly, but the thing about living wills is as follows. I don't believe in living wills, unless we're talking about very extreme situations that are specifying, you know, I want X, Y, and Z done in this scenario, but not, you know, this and another scenario. It's hard to project those. It's hard to project in advance. But the living wills that are good are conversation primers that help people start to talk out with their families. They're general, how they see these things. Once you get that conversation going, it's a lot easier to keep up those conversations as people's health conditions evolve. And that's why it's super important that have some form of initial conversation, record that, not making specific decisions, but to get a general sense. I like, you know, and a lot of times those conversations go where people discuss their own encounters with death, whether it's their parents or siblings or their friends. You know, I liked how my mom died in her house surrounded with her kids. I didn't like how Uncle Dave had this, whatever it might be, right? Those types of things are very valuable. And then you keep on going and keep up those conversations as much as you can until you can. But as you point out, there are times when you can't have those conversations, and you do your best. You do your best in terms of trying to figure out what's best in this situation. And it is very, very, very hard. Do not always know for sure. And end of life decision making and this type of care has to be made in a world of uncertainty. Right. Which is why I think we should be a little bit modest. And particularly, you know, occasionally I see cases because of the work I'm doing at my organization and other conversations where people are very judgmental of one person in a lot of different directions. Why they do this? Why do they do that? I think we should relax a little bit about being judgmental a lot of times because, you know, we are in a world of uncertainty in these cases. So thank you for that comment. I think it's very valuable. Len, I'm sorry I didn't see you earlier. Go ahead.
Not a problem. I just want to make a simple point based on both professional and personal experience, and that is that knowledgeable doctors and knowledgeable chaplains, rabbis, particularly in Jewish nursing homes and the like, really have a lot more agreement than people realize about what is and what is not appropriate for, you know, patients who are close to their end of their life. Now, I'll give you just one small example. The issue of feeding tubes. Doctors will tell you that there's a large percentage of people who get feeding tubes that end up with painful infections and end up with much more suffering as a result of having the feeding tube put in. And I think that's very influential in terms of how a rabbi will advise a family and a doctor will give the same advice. And my point in all of this is there's a real issue of education. Lay leadership, pulpit rabbis have to be educated a lot better as to the changing technology and the pros and the cons of these various medical interventions.
Len, I agree with you fully on that point. Literally, we're trying to build our website right now that's going to be doing those types of educational programs. And I just was in Los Angeles filming in the Cedars-Sinai Hospital, and they have a simulation room. It's 10 different rooms. It's unbelievable. It's like a hall they have there in Los Angeles. And which we are simulating, right? These types of scenarios, DNRs, DNIs, like explaining to people all these factors. But I don't fully agree that everyone always agrees with what's right or wrong. And how, I think there's a value judgment coming up there. And I think that there's more room for reasonable disagreement sometimes about what's valuable or not. And, you know, and there, I think it gets a little more complicated, but you are absolutely correct. These conversations sound different in theory, whether it's a Beit Midrash or in the academia, and look very different in a hospital ward. And one of the philosophers that's very critical of physician-assisted suicide, PAS, who says we cannot have doctors do these things. If you're in a hospital, you'll understand why this is bad for doctors to do this. It says, you want to do PAS? Let's bring in all the philosophers. Let's do philosopher-assisted suicide. And then you'll see, right, where it gets complicated. Now, there are many physicians, of course, disagree with that or anything, right? But the point that he's making, which I think is true, is that it definitely, these are interesting theoretical conversations, but they really need to be rooted in reality and understanding what the technology is. And I'll tell you one other thing, which is that a lot of these issues that get driven by debates that happened, let's say, in the 70s and 80s, maybe by, let's say, by Rabbi Waldenberg, Jacobitz, and others, really need to be updated for the technology that we have 40 years later. I mean, some of the issues are the same. Some of the issues are very different. You know, PEGs, what do PEGs do? PEGs are always, that always a good idea, right? You know, right. Artificial thing and ECMOs and all sorts of other technology that's, I think is changing us, and we have to update a bit of some of this conversation. So thank you for the point.
Kol hakavod for the work you're doing. Very important work.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Really appreciate it. Okay, I'll stay on, Shira. I know if anyone wants to get any questions, but this was a great conversation, and I look forward to continuing in the coming weeks.
Thank you very much.
Wow, so good.
Very enjoyable, Rabbi. Thank you. I have two of Fred Rosner's books. They're a little bit old, but I have Medicine and Jewish Law, Volume 1, and Pioneers in Medical Ethics. And I've read Dr. Tendler and Rabbi, who was the great postcum that passed away. Not Auerbach, that's another person. Anyway, Moshe Feinstein.
Moshe Feinstein, sure. I recommend the book. I mean, we need some more books, but my colleague, Rabbi Jason Weiner in Toronto, has a book called, it's right next to me, The Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision Making. I think it's probably the most up-to-date and accessible book on these topics. There are others as well, but I think it's very good. And he's a very
What was the last name of the author?
Weiner, Weiner. He's the chief chaplain at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. We're doing a lot of work together in Matai, and I think he does some very good work. So
no credentials whatsoever, right?
I'm sorry?
I said, so no credentials whatsoever, right?
Oh, yeah, he's an impressive guy.
Yeah, right. Thank you. I appreciate that.
On these issues, yeah.
Are you going to put the sources on?
I couldn't make that out of the question.
Rabbi Brody, you're going to send me your source sheets so I can post it online?
Yes. I'm sorry about that. Yes, I'll do that. I'll send that.
Okay. So I'll get that up there as soon as I receive it from Rabbi Brody. I will post that on program page for this class on our website.
Could you please repeat the title of the book?
It's called Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision Making.
Thank you.
Put in the chat as well. Jewish Guide to Practical Medical
Decision Making. Shoshana, can I play back in a few minutes?
And the author is Jason Weiner. Okay, any other comments or questions? If not, we'll pick
Thank you very much. Wonderful, Shir. Thank you.
Thank you. Jolene.
Well, thank you, Dr. Rabbi.
Rabbi, there was a question. I mean, you're dealing with a slippery slope question, which in most Jewish ethics you come across how much of this or how much of that. But the case that I put in the chat about Rabbi Yochanan was a case of praying for somebody to pass away who had mental illness, not physical illness, when he went crazy after after Reish Lakish passed away.
I'm trying to find your chat commentary. I don't see it, but yeah, that is an interesting case. It is an interesting case. And the question is, what type of suffering we do keep in mind? And This is a huge issue right now in Canada as they continue to expand their maid laws. And we'll get to discussing it in the coming weeks as well. But yeah, I mean, mental health counts. I mean, we do care about mental health. There's no doubt about it.
Go on, sorry.
No, please, go ahead.
And then the case where the woman mentioned about the physicians, about when there's, it's futile, and you used a different word for it. There's also considerations of physician burnout dealing with this too much. So it's not just on the patient side. How do you navigate so that your physicians don't go into work thinking, well, today I'm going to, be forced to kill another five people or supervise it or the like. There's two sides of the coin that way, the person suffering and the people treating them.
Absolutely. And but this goes both ways. I mean, I can tell you that in recent weeks, I've had a lot of conversations with nurses, doctors who feel moral angst about performing treatments on people, which they feel are medically inappropriate and are causing someone to suffer. Particularly it comes up when they're asked to try to resuscitate someone who they think they're just causing pain to, but are in prolonging their death. That comes up a lot, and that comes up in Israel a lot. And so it goes a lot of directions here. But yes, absolutely. How these questions impact the people you're asking to do this is certainly part of the equation. You have to keep in mind. Jolene.
I'm going to relate an interesting case. It's in Canada, and it applies to Canada, not the United States. In Canada, 4 out of 5 of patients who are victims of medical error die. Now, they don't die because of the severity of the error. So it's in the operating room and a sponge is left in. No, they die because of the open denial of care afterward. And I was one of those people. And why I'm bringing this forward is that there was a Medical Service Commission hearing involving the Attorney General into my specific case that physicians, chief of staffs, hospitals, it deliberately interfered with care to the point I would have died if I'd not gone out of country for care. And the definition was criminal medical fraud. And so that's why the Attorney General was involved. And there is a RCMP file number on it. And the RCMP said I live because I went to the United States. And so it was reckless disregard. And the RCMP said, no, it was homicide because the intent was to kill you. Now, why this matters in all of this is that in Canada, for physicians, it remains pressure put on them to deny care to patients who are victims of medical error. And someone just mentioned physician burnout. And this applies to that because physicians are put pressure on them to not provide care. And I always wonder who is the greater victim? The person who is victim of the medical error or the physician who was not allowed to provide care? And because this impacts thousands, literally thousands of people across Canada, it's, it's medical ethics. It involves death. It involves, in a way, physician assisted suicide because the patient wants to live, but the doctor can't provide care because of the policies. Now, the result of my hearing, okay, the decision was that it was all right for the doctors to not provide care for me, even though they falsified reports and like MRI reports and all the other things. It was open that they knew when they did it that they were lying on the report. But the decision in Canada was that this was all right to do because it was important to protect a publicly funded universal care system. Wow. So when we get into talking about MAID and the programs that are now coming into Canada, such as the MOST program, which where the physician decides the care that the patient comes, that this political you want to call it, a political agenda in countries with a socialized medicine, it becomes part of this conversation. So I know in the United States that many people say that my Medical Service Commission hearing was one of the most important things that happened in Canada. Because it wouldn't happen in the United States. I went to the United States over a dozen times. The American physicians were absolutely wonderful, which is beside the point. So yeah. The last thing in closing on this is that I want to thank you very much. And I want to personally thank Torah in Motion. Is that I'm taking this back to court. The right for Canadians to live as they would so choose, and the right for physicians to provide care for them. And Torah in Motion and all of those who ask questions and all the rabbis that teach encourage me, empower me to just to step forward and do what is right and good for all of our people. And so a special thanks to everyone today who asked questions, because not only did I learn from the lesson, but I learned from all of you. And thank you so much. Bye.
Yeah, Jolene, I put my email here in the chat. And if you know, if you're able to send me an email just with a link, the case or some of the coverage or whatever it might be, I'd be very curious to see it. And obviously raises a lot of issues that come up, and hopefully we'll get to discuss it. But it's director@hodes.org. If you send me an email with that link, that'd be great. So thank you for sharing that.
Well, thank you to you all, and I will get in touch with you and send you the documents, the legal documents.
Great. Okay. Have a great day, everyone. Good to see you all.
Good to see you.